welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to a special production of Listen to Older Voices. Recently, Listen to Older Voices was part of a day celebrating older people. Hosted by the Melbourne Project, the special guest speaker was none other than a real icon of Australian film, television and radio, Mr. Charles Bud Tingwall. So we present part one of a two-part program featuring Bud's address to the large group that had been invited to attend the celebration in Healesville, Victoria. In this week's program, Bud candidly talks about how he began his career in radio, where his first real professional job was a radio play with the late, great Jack Davey. Putting it simply, Bud is completely engaging. So without more ado, we hear from Melba's coordinator, Kath Holton, introducing Bud.
I'd like to ask Bud Tingwall to make his way to the microphone, and I'm sure you all know Bud. Well, I feel like everybody has a personal relationship with Bud because he's been in our lounge rooms and our hearts for a long time. And I'd like to particularly welcome him.
Well, listen, I haven't done this for quite a while. I must tell you my sad story. I had the best... I know what that is. That's another part of Churchill's revenge. I'll explain what I mean by that. Last August, I was asked to play probably the best part any geriatric, very elderly, stupid old actor could get. I was cast as Winston Churchill in a movie. I didn't think I'd get the part because they kept saying, well, we've got to, you know, check with the bosses. And the bosses happened to be Film Australia, who make a lot of brilliant documentaries, and ABC Television, and it was a co-production. And I think there was some discussion as to whether it was a good idea to have a fairly geriatric old actor with a bit of a familiar face playing a very, very famous geriatric old bloke called Winston Churchill. However, they decided to let me play it. And I thought, well, that's great. It was a wonderful script, beautifully researched, because there's a mountain of stuff, of the real thing with Churchill and all his mates back in that period. So eventually they said, yeah, you're playing it. Good. So my first day shooting was on the 13th of August, and I fell on the way to makeup, broke my little finger, smashed my face in the... Nothing broke, thank goodness, and nearly broke some equipment that had been lying around. And I thought, I have a funny feeling I shouldn't have done this role. To start work on the 13th of August, fall before your first big scene, and that ain't a good idea in movies and things, because as fun as movies can be, gee, they're very concentrated, especially if there's 40 people saying, you got it wrong, it was, we will fight on the beaches, and there's, oh, sorry, I looked up the wrong bit. And being in the right age group for Churchill, I thought I knew everything, all his speeches, because I was in the Air Force in 1941 to about 1946, 47, and we were very rude about the masters. We used to do rude versions of Churchill and Menzies and Roosevelt in the bar at night, sloshed. And I thought, when I fell, on the way down, I thought, oh, he's getting at me, he's getting at me. This is his revenge. So anyway, we did my part, and I finished about a fortnight later, very concentrated shoot. And I was due to finish that evening, a Tuesday night, as I remember. And I started to feel really crook. So I apologise for the use of the word crook. I have got it in use now fully in about four or five different hospitals around Melbourne, because I'm just out of hospital. Anyhow, we finished the shoot, and at the end of the day, I'm feeling really crook. And I thought, oh, no, I've got a virus, I think. Two of my grandchildren had viruses, and everybody's saying, be careful, you'll get a virus. The next morning, on a Wednesday morning, I woke up and I was supposed to go to the launch of the new Homicide series. And I felt terrible, so I rang and said, look, I don't think I can come. I feel really awful. I said, I think I've got some sort of virus. And anyway, I hope it goes well. The next morning, Thursday morning, my daughter came down with her 13-year-old to see how I was. And she took one look at me and said, oh, and rang the doctor. Dr. Lim, our GP, turned up. He took one look at me and went, oh, rang an ambulance. Next thing I know, I'm in an ambulance zooming off to Box Hill Hospital, wondering what the heck's hit me. And apparently, I'd had an internal hemorrhage, which started on the Tuesday night. And so I'm now warning anybody, be careful, it may not be a virus. If my eagle-eyed daughter hadn't rung the doctor, I don't know what might have happened. Because I kept having units of blood, I had 6 units of blood, my hemoglobin count was down to 6 or 6.5 or something, which I think is just about death time, but anyhow, I had a cup of tea and felt better. Because I'm a very elderly geriatric ex-serviceman, I've got a gold card, and not many people here today are old enough to have a gold card, I don't think. And so they discovered that I didn't have to stay in Box Hill. I could go across the road to the posh Epworth Eastern. So I went across to Epworth Eastern. So I've been in and out of hospital ever since August the 13th. And a couple of days after, I think it was a week or so after, my daughter's looking and she said, has your little finger always been that shape? And it was all sort of bent. And I said, no, I don't think so. So they took us into the X-ray department, and as I fell, I broke my finger. And now I can't straighten it. But when the doctor had a look at it, he said, look, we can't do much about it, but if you like, we could straighten it. He said, but it would be permanently straight. So I had the big decision to make as to whether to have a slightly bent little finger or a straight little finger. And I've decided the slightly bent little finger is probably better.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories.
Now listen, I better stop rabbiting on, unless I say something of interest. I have been in this business an awfully long time. I'm 193 years old this year. But I've got two mates. We all flew Spitfires in various parts of the Air Force and got our wings together and trained together. And John and Alf are identical twins, completely identical. And we were training in Canada. We started training in Australia and our batch was sent to Canada. And we were all training as fighter pilots. But John and Alf are identical twins. And when they were 19, as we were when we were doing our wings training, you could not tell them apart. It was extraordinary. So they could fly for each other if one felt crook. And it broke every rule in the book. Even the Air Force broke the rule. Normally they would never allow such close relatives to be on the same Air Force station, let alone fly the same sort of aircraft. But anyway, they let John and Alf fly together. And they survived. And I flew Spitfires as well, but not on... I was trained as a fighter pilot, but my operational flying was on what was called long-range photographic reconnaissance. And we would fly over the enemy territory and we would take pictures of everything the German army didn't want us to take pictures of. Very interesting job. Sad thing was that we knew what was happening long before General Montgomery or any of the boys did. Very interesting thing, but John and Alf were fair dinkum fighter pilots. They were both shot down, both survived. There's a fabulous report of when John was shot down. He got out of the aircraft. It was a crash landing and found himself lying down in some soft ground. And when he woke up in the morning, there's a dirty great tiger looking at him. And he knew where his aerodrome was. It was way over the mountains somewhere over that way. And he had to get all the way back to his aerodrome with this flaming great tiger stalking him. And one night he thought he'd beaten it and lost it until he woke up in the morning. There's this huge footprint absolutely close to where he was lying. So it was a very friendly tiger. Or maybe there was something wrong with being an Australian in that part. John wrote it up very well a couple of years ago now, and one of the Air Force publications printed it. If you put it in a movie, nobody would believe it, but it was fairly... They turned 85. They're older than I am by about 3 months, and they turned 85 whenever it was, September or something last year. And then I caught up with them in January, so I'm now 85. And it all hurts. Gordon Chater was a great mate of mine, and we used to ring each other round about birthday time. And he was very fond of my wife, and April was his birthday, and I'm January. And I remember the last phone call I had was from Gordon saying, I said, "How are you going?" He said, "Old age is dreadful. Oh, everything hurts." Gordon was a very posh Englishman who learned how to speak Australian when he started to do a lot of telly. Although we did a lot of shows, you know, theatre shows and things, and a million, you know, eps of radio things. But because he had a good, nice, posh English accent, he got lots of good, posh English roles to play. But when telly started and he was working with our other mate, Johnny Mellon, they all had to talk Australian. And but when he rang me and complained about his age and everything hurting, he was very, very posh English again. Everything hurts. And he was right. Now, how did I get into this business? I started when I was at Randwick Intermediate High School in Sydney. I was hoping to get into Sydney High School, but I didn't get enough marks in the primary final. But I went to Randwick High School because we lived in Coogee, and Randwick High was just up the road. And had my name not started with a T, I probably would never have been an actor, because I found that we were divided up alphabetically, and the A's and the B's were up the posh end of the classroom, and the T's and Z's and they were down the bottom end, and I found myself sitting next to Owen Weingott, whose name started with W. So the T's and the W together, and it was great because we were right down the crook end of the classroom, and we could natter. And we'd both discovered that I was 12, I think, and Owen was 13. He was a year older than me. And we'd discovered this new thing called radio drama. Though we didn't use such posh words as drama, it was radio plays and radio serials. And this would have been 1935. And radio was absolutely magic. Much better than telly, because the sets were better and the scenery was wonderful and the girls were so beautiful. You had to close your eyes, of course, and do a bit of imagining. But we got very good at imagining what we were supposed to be performing. But anyhow, Owen talked me into playing a part in a school or a classroom production. And we did some silly sketches and things. And then he said, "Listen," he said, "I'm going to do an adaptation of A Tale of Two Cities." I said, "We can't do that in the classroom. It's about the French Revolution." He said, "Oh, no, she'll be right." And he said, "You can be in it." I said, "Oh, what am I playing?" He said, "Lucy Manette." So my first proper role was playing Lucy Manette in a rugby league playing boys' high school in Sydney. And I had to borrow a dress of Mum's. And Owen was very dark-haired, and he was playing my father, old Mr. Manette. And he had his head full of Johnson's baby powder to look grey and elderly. And when we were doing a performance in front of the classroom, God, what they must have thought. And he got rather emotional in one part of the scene, and his head was flying around. All I could see was this great cloud of Johnson baby powder falling down on Mum's dress. Anyhow, I got it home and everything was all right and Mum didn't mind. But that made him very ambitious. We started doing all sorts of shows, and then his ambition went a little bit beyond just classroom stuff. And there were some interesting radio shows starting up in those days. This is now about the late 30s, I guess. And there was a fellow called Rod Gainford in Sydney who had a show called Do You Want to Be an Actor? And it was open to any particularly amateur actors who wanted to have a bit of a go. And what you did was you went along and you picked out specially written little sketches and things, usually by amateurs, and you picked out something that you thought you could do. And Owen, of course, went in and won his heat. He went on to win the finals. I won nothing. And I remember on the first time we both appeared, Owen went on to win the finals that night. I didn't get anything except right at the end, Rod Gainford said, oh, we've been sent up a 10-shilling prize for the young man in the light sports coat. And that was me. We'd bought a sports coat, Mum and I, a sale at David Jones for 10 bob. And that was my new jacket.
And this is Listen to Older Voices. Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. And on today's program is Bud Tingwall.
Anyhow, Owen went on to do terribly well. The night we won, took part, the finals that night, which represented about the last 4 weeks of competition, was won by a young lady called Joy Nichols, who went on to have a fantastic career in England. But you're mostly Australians, aren't you? So you won't know who she is. Oh, what have I said? Now, Joy went on to have a fabulous career in England, did all sorts of shows like Take It From Here and everything. So I love looking back at that, because there she was being brilliant as a competitor in Do You Want to Be an Actor? Owen retained his great enthusiasm. After we'd done Do You Want to Be an Actor, he said, there's a new competition starting called The Play Goes On. He said, we'll take part in that. I said, what's it all about? He said, well, this is for amateur drama groups. I said, but we're not in an amateur drama group. He said, we'll form one. So we formed an amateur drama group consisting of two fellas. I was then 14, I think, or 13, and Owen was 15. And by then we'd gone to different schools. Owen went on to the Great Sydney High School. I was mad keen to go there because they had Sydney Girls High just over the fence, and I'd heard a rumour that when they did plays and things, they could do plays with real girls. And given my disastrous appearance as Lucy Manette, I was determined to stay well away from women's roles from then on. But they could do proper plays with proper girls and everything. And I went on to Sydney Grammar School, which Dad thought was a good idea. And they had a very good drama group, but it was all fellas. But we did some good work, and I got a few good comedy roles, and particularly in The Crimson Coconut. It's a drama about coconuts all changing colour, and when they were bright red, they became a bomb. And I don't know who won that, but still, I think I got a good report in the school magazine. But Owen did some fair dinkum proper work with at Sydney High, and we went into this competition for real drama groups. And we got away with it somehow. We had to find a play that was suitable for our group. Or we had to find a play with only two fellas in it. And we couldn't find one. The best we could do was to find a play with two fellas and one girl. So Owen rang one of his girlfriends from Sydney Girls High School, and she came along and helped us out. Owen did all the organising. We did it at 2GB. We had a very fine producer, John Appleton, who was in charge of the whole competition. And we did our little play with all the other competitors that night. Next thing I know, I get a call from the producer of the competition. offering me one of the leads in a radio serial starring Jack Davey. And Jack was sort of, the Graham Kennedy of the old days. Brilliant man, Jack. And he was playing, they cast him in, it was Billy Bunter of Greyfriars, and he was playing Billy Bunter, the little fat schoolboy. And I was invited to play Bob Cherry, one of the genuine schoolboys. And then poor Owen had done all this work, organising the whole thing, and I cracked it for a fair dinkum professional role. Thrown right into the deep end, not only Jack Davey, but we had great actors like Howard Craven and Ronald Morse. And these were all the top blokes. And there was little me being the only genuine schoolboy. And we used to record my stuff after school hours. I was at Sydney Grammar School in College Street. And at 3:30, I used to walk across the park, go to the TNG building and right up to the roof where they had a recording studio, and I'd do all my episodes after school. But it whetted my appetite. I rather liked the whole process, and it was good fun, and I found I could do it. And at the end of that year, Dad had wanted me to become an accountant, and I did get a job for a while at one of the posh accountants in Sydney, Smith Johnson and Company, but promptly failed the elementary exam, which is very hard to do. The elementary exam is eminently passable, except by me. I didn't do it on purpose. I didn't have to. I was just crook enough. My natural crook talent was good. Anyhow, Dad was great. Because at the end of the year, he said, look, if you're still keen on all this, have a go at this. And he handed me an advertisement from the Sydney Morning Herald, which was offering a post for a young man to be a cadet announcer panel operator at a well-known commercial radio station in Sydney, which turned out to be Station 2CH, which was a very interesting station. It was partly run by the Council of Churches. I think they held the license. AWA, the great manufacturer of all the good electronic gear in those days, they were part owners, and they had a lot of very, very senior announcers and skillful people running the station. The main problem they had was they couldn't advertise anything on a Sunday because of the connection with the church. So they never had a lot of money coming in. But the discipline of working for them was marvellous. So I had a proper job for which I was paid £3 a week. It was very embarrassing when I joined the Air Force because in those days, the Air Force rules or the service rules were that if your wages in the services were smaller than your job, the employer you just left had to make up the difference and put it into a sort of trust fund. What was embarrassing for me was I was paid more in the Air Force than I was as an announcer at 2CH. I think as an aircrew trainee, I got £3.76 or something. And as a cadet announcer, I got £3 a week. But I managed to somehow steer away from all well-paid jobs. I've never been paid a lot of money. I got a call to go to Hollywood in 1952. For a war film called The Desert Rats with a promising young bloke called Richard Burton, who was playing the lead. And I remember I was a last-minute bit of casting, so it was very hectic to get onto a plane in time and get to Los Angeles. And it was a slower trip in those days. You had to go to there first and over there and then to Los Angeles. And I arrived on a Sunday afternoon, much later than they expected, and they had the car waiting to take me straight out to the studio to sign a contract, because I didn't have a contract. All I had was a phone call from America through a friend in Sydney, and could I get on a plane in a hurry? So, yes, I did. And when we got to the studio, this huge studio, 20th Century Fox, on a Sunday afternoon, totally empty. It was very eerie, but they zoomed us over to the office block, and there was the great casting director, Billy Gordon, in his tracky dacks and looking very relaxed, and his wife was with him, and she was in tracky dacks, and they'd been waiting all day for me. And the first thing he said to me was, you're here. Right. He said, now, I suppose you've heard we pay very, very big wages to all our actors. I said, yeah. He said, well, we don't, and promptly proved it. He said, we're offering you the part of Lieutenant Carstairs. It sounds like it's about fifth of the top or something. And I thought, just being here is good fun. So they paid me $350 a week. I got an allowance to pay the hotel they put me up in. And I worked it out that I was earning £4 a week more as a radio actor in Sydney. So when they offered us a seven-year contract, they said, you know, keen on sign? I said, no, thanks. I'm going home. So we did the film. I was offered a seven-year contract. There were a few headlines. Tingle turns down contract. I don't think I was ever game to tell them how little they were going to pay me on my seven-year contract. But I've since found out that it was quite normal. I saw a very good documentary about Debbie Reynolds recently. And it came out that her first 2 years when she was under contract, probably to the same studio, 20th Century Fox, she was on $300 a week for the first 2 years.
I invite you to tune in next week at the same time to hear the conclusion of Bud's talk. Among his stories are his time in the Air Force, how he came to get the nickname Bud, and further stories of his remarkable career, including his days as Inspector Reg Lawson in the highly popular Crawford production of Homicide. Next week on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.